Hey, Funky listeners, welcome back to Funk Radio, your favorite podcast that has us in it.
And only us.
Who are you?
I'm Kyle.
And I'm Peter.
Yes.
Before we get started with our main topic for today, Kyle.
Yes.
Two things that we should knock off our list. One, I think you should tell our listeners what you thought of the new Pop-Tart flavor you tried this week.
Oh, God. Yeah, I've been searching for new Pop-Tart flavors to try since we last discussed the, I guess, new flavors that'll be coming out between now and 2016. And I found a flavor that I'm not sure was on the list, but I bought it because whatever. It was peanut butter and jelly. And it didn't taste good. It tasted like peanut butter and jelly crammed into like one of those wafers you get at church. So it's like peanut butter, jelly, and Jesus.
What?
You know, like, you know.
But those have no taste.
Exactly. Exactly. It was like peanut butter and jelly crammed into like a completely tasteless pastry.
That's so sad.
Which is weird because it had frosting. But the frosting was just peanut butter. So it was just extra peanut butter with like flavorless Jesus pastry.
So was it peanut butter and strawberry jelly? Because I thought it said strawberry on the picture that you showed me.
Yes. Yeah, it was peanut butter and strawberry jelly, which the strawberry... The jelly of the strawberry thing basically just tasted like a strawberry Pop-Tart. Mm. And then you just cram peanut butter in there. But the peanut butter had this really weird, not super peanut buttery taste. It was kind of just salty. So it's like a salty strawberry Pop-Tart that also tastes like Jesus.
Well,
it's the Holy Trinity, Father, Peanut, and Holy Jelly.
I'm sure that's a review that they will never hear anywhere else.
Yeah, your Pop-Tart is like the Holy Trinity of crap.
Of terrible flavors. Yeah. Well, that's one thing down. Thank you, Kyle, for exploring the flavors for us.
Yeah, more reviews to come as they come out.
The other thing is... Oh, let's try to keep this brief, but do you want to tell us what you thought of the movie San Andreas?
Yeah. So I watched a couple movies over the weekend, and one of them that I watched that I figured was worth talking about was the movie San Andreas with The Rock. The best way I can describe the plot is it's just The Rock running from rocks. Because like 80% of the movie is just, here's a bunch of CGI shots of buildings falling down. Here's some more buildings falling down. Here's The Rock saying, oh my god, the buildings are falling down. It's so funny because I remember there was a part towards the end where the earthquake somehow caused a tsunami that came back at the coast, which doesn't make any sense because usually tsunamis are caused by underwater earthquakes and the San Andreas Fault is not underwater.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, I don't know if that could happen.
So it's like there's an earthquake that shakes San Francisco, and then all of a sudden a tsunami comes at San Francisco that is somehow also caused by the earthquake, even though the fault line is east of the coast. It was just like, oh, we have to throw in a giant tidal wave here just so we can destroy the Golden Gate Bridge because it's iconic.
Well, nothing you said surprised me one bit.
Yeah, I like The Rock, and I like that he really does not take himself seriously in most movies, but like, the range of his acting in that movie was just like, I'm serious in a dangerous situation, and I'm serious because I'm The Rock. I'm very serious.
Oh boy. Well, listeners, take that review as you will. Mm-hmm. If you want to see that movie.
Please do, because it's awesome.
Then do that. If you don't, then don't.
Yeah.
Until then, you can listen to us talk for the next 40 minutes or so.
Yay.
About something else. Should I? I guess I should introduce the topic for today.
Possibly, since you researched it more than I.
That's true. Well, listeners, as you may have guessed from the title of the episode or wherever you may be finding this, we're going to talk a little bit today about a record label called TK Records that was based in Miami, Florida, in throughout the 70s until I believe in 81 it went bankrupt. But throughout the 70s when it was around, it was one of the primary powerhouses of disco music. And you know, a lot of the pioneering people of that genre came out of this label you know, during that time. So partly because we basically never mentioned this record label, I feel like it's, and some of the artists that we'll be talking about, I felt that it was important to cover this. Because, you know, on the show, we always are talking about Motown Records. We're always talking about, we've talked about Stax a couple of times. Mm-hmm. There's probably a couple of others.
Muscle Shoals,
that's true.
Yeah.
Philly International. But we haven't, because, you know, I think primarily we usually stick to soul and funk music, but we do talk about disco, but not as much. So that's probably why we haven't talked about TK Records yet.
Mm-hmm.
But by the end of this episode, you, listeners, and us will be more educated on this thing.
First of all, can you tell me what TK stands for?
I can. I, for some reason, did not write it down because I wasn't sure if you were going to ask.
I asked.
TK is actually the thank you. TK is actually the initials of the sound engineer that built like their first sound studio.
Nice.
For the founder, Henry Stone.
See, they should have called it Stone Records.
They should have called it Rock Records, and then I was, made rock music, and then the rock could have
rock been record.
The head of it. And then he could have been so serious all the time.
Exactly. This music-making business is very serious.
The founder of the label is Henry Stone. He was originally a record distributor in the 60s and 70s, and then throughout the early 70s, he actually created several different record labels, most of which either later became or were just always a sub-label of TK. And I want to say TK had like 24 sub-labels to it.
Jeez. It's like Motown, but worse.
Pretty much, yeah. But yeah, like I was saying earlier, TK Records was kind of one of the primary breeding grounds of early disco music in the early 70s. And some of these were actually, you know, earlier, several years earlier than what a lot of people consider to be the golden age of disco, which was basically 77 to 79, I think.
Very true. I guess getting right off and starting with some of the first stuff produced at TK Records before disco really took off. One guy that we want to talk about, who is one of those songs where a lot of people know the song, they don't know the guy, is the song Why Can't We Live Together by Timmy Thomas, which is a really cool name. That was produced in 1972 and was actually the very first song distributed by TK, well before the days of disco. If you listen to it, it's clearly much more soul-inspired than a lot of their later hits because it's much less, you know, orchestral and produced, very down-to-earth. And it has organ, which is, it seems like it seems like soul always had organs in it for some reason because gospel influence, I guess.
Yeah.
But Timmy Thomas in the 60s was part of an R&B group called Philip and the Faithfuls, and he later went on to become a session musician at the Memphis-based Gold Wax label. He didn't really find any success there until he moved on to Glades Records in Florida, one of the many subsidiary labels of TK, as Peter just said. The song, Why Can't We Live Together, once released, actually quickly climbed up to become a number one R&B hit and sell over 2 million copies. So, as we said, totally one of those songs where it's like, I know that song, but no one knows the dude. Maybe, I don't know if that means he was a one-hit wonder, I guess. So, maybe not, I don't know.
Probably. But, I mean, I had actually never heard of Timmy Thomas until doing research for this.
I haven't either. Isn't Timmy, like, or isn't Tim, or can't Tim be like a shortened name for Thomas? So technically he could be Thomas, or am I dumb?
Well, I mean, it's short for Timothy, right?
Oh, you're right. I'm dumb. Yep.
But, I mean, I guess Tommy would be short for Thomas.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, man, he could have been Tommy Thomas.
No, he's Timmy Tommy.
Timmy Tommy. Timmy Tommy. Rub your timmy tummy.
Well, listeners, let's listen to a quick clip of Why Can't We Live Together?
By Timmy Tummy.
Everybody wants to live together. Why can't we live together?
Why can't we live together, listeners?
Because we'd run out of room in a house, in our house.
No, we wouldn't. It's like two or three people. We'd make it work.
We should start our own reality show where, like, all the listeners of Funk Radio live under one roof and it's just, like, seven people. It's the new real world.
It's, oh, God.
Real world. People that listen to bad podcasts.
So, yeah, as you listeners probably heard, very, kind of a very stripped down style to that. Not very much going on. I mean, they had, like, the organ. He was singing, and I think there may be some kind of drum or rhythm machine going on as well. But other than that, I mean, that's pretty much all it was.
Pretty much.
I included it in this list because I felt it was important to kind of just say what the very first song was, you know, that came out of TK Records. But also, it's funny because you say that you've heard this song before, Kyle.
Mm-hmm.
I had never heard it until maybe a month ago in like a mix of other, like a bunch of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I made a mental note. I was like, oh, that's kind of like a soul sounding song I've never heard before. But I never bothered to look up who it was or what the song was, you know, separately from that.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was doing research for this, I was like, hey, that name sounds familiar. I looked it up and it was that song. So kind of a weird coincidence there for me. I don't know where if you've heard it before.
I think I've heard it on that XM station I listen to.
Oh, okay.
Is my best guess. But yeah, I have heard it.
Interesting. Yeah, it's funny that when like you kind of are accidentally introduced to a song and then realize that it was actually a pretty popular song.
Exactly.
That you never heard of.
Exactly.
I like to think that we are pretty well-rounded with our knowledge of this stuff, but you know, there's always new things to learn.
For sure. Yeah, there's
if there wasn't, then we would stop making episodes.
True. Maybe just because it's of my inexperience with disco, but yeah, there's quite a few artists in here I've never heard of before.
Yeah, I mean, we don't, like I said, we don't really talk about disco as much.
True.
And we don't really get into it as much, but you know, baby steps, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
Although, ironically, the next song we're going to talk about, Rock Your Baby by George McRae, is actually one that we talked about on our very first episode. over 3 years ago now.
Excuse me. I'm old.
Yeah. And I believe the reason I brought it up in that episode is that episode is more about just like, what did we do over the summer? Some stuff we learned, concerts we saw.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a song that I first discovered during that summer. So
nice.
So so the order that we wrote these songs in, kind of chronological in a sense. So obviously the one we just talked about was from 1972, the very first one from this label. Rock Your Baby came out in 1974, so still pretty early in the records, in TK Records' career, but it's not, you know, not the first song that came out, but is by far one of the more famous ones that came out of that. In itself, Rock Your Baby is actually considered the second ever hit of the disco era, following only Rock the Boat by the Hughes Corporation. I don't know if we ever talked about that song, but I know we both know it.
Yeah. I don't remember. Which is sad because I actually have that on vinyl. It's one of my few disco albums.
Oh, nice.
Something about disco and rocking things, apparently they got confused. It's like,
that's true.
We want our genre to be rock, but we're just going to say the word rock a lot. And that's when the rock came in and rocked everyone's boat. You know, in the movie, the San Andreas, he's actually in a boat. So technically, it is Rock the Boat. Because it's the rock in a boat.
Good job, Kyle. Are you just going to be making rock puns the entire time?
Hell yes.
So, yeah, like I said, Rock the Boat by the Hughes Corporation was apparently considered the first hit of the disco era. Which I actually had to go back and listen to it because I didn't really remember it being too disco-y. But actually, I can see that.
Yeah.
I looked up, you know, okay, so Rock Your Baby was the second one behind this. When did they come out in relation to each other? They actually both came out in May of 1974.
Hmm.
I couldn't get actual dates. Obviously, Rock the Boat must have come out only within a couple of weeks before Rock Your Baby, so.
True that.
This was almost the very first disco hit. Anyway, I should say that this is one of the earliest hits co-written by Harry Wayne Casey and Richard Finch, and you probably don't recognize those names, but they were actually founding members of Casey and the Sunshine Band, and they were overall pioneers in the disco sound. And you'll probably hear those names coming up a couple times in this episode, particularly Harry Wayne Casey, because he was basically in this record label, you know, from day one, more or less, and he became, you know, one of the biggest names in disco in itself, but also in terms of just this record label, he had a really big hand in like developing that sound and everything, and producing other artists. Let's see. So I actually have a quote for Richard Finch, one of the co-writers of the song. He says, and I found this kind of interesting. He says, quote, and this is kind of excerpted. I cut out pieces here and there, but you'll get the idea. He said, Harry and I were paying attention to the chart actions at clubs because club records were doing better than just regular R&B records. Back then, you could sneak into a club and they didn't check your ID. So Harry and I would once in a while go and sneak into the local clubs. We'd pay attention to what brought people to the dance floor and what made them sit down. So we started gearing ourselves to writing more in that direction. Rock Your Baby was inspired by the gathering of all that information. So I found that kind of interesting that they actually kind of went into the place where disco music, you know, grew, which was dance clubs. And they studied, okay, this type of music.
They did research.
Exactly, they did research. Probably more research than we do for this show.
they're disco scientists.
Exactly. So I found that kind of interesting that instead of just like studying, you know, charts or record sales or something, they actually went down into the clubs and seed what people like to dance to.
It's funny because now I'm just imagining like old 70s film of like people in nightclubs that's like is like a voiceover from like, you know, some British guy, like, and we see here the male venturing over to the dance floor watering hole to entice some females
with large posteriors.
Exactly.
So another interesting quote here that I'll read, it's a bit shorter, before we play a clip of this song. Henry Stone, as we said, the founder of the label, he said, quote, I suggested to Harry that Gwen McRae, George McRae's wife, might be a good contender to cut the track. But just then George walked in and I told Harry to let George have a go first. And we'll talk about Gwen McRae actually after we talk about George. But I found it interesting that there were a lot of like little anecdotes of this record label from the early days where stuff kind of just happened by accident. And in this case, this became George McRae's biggest hit by far, the second hit of the disco era, all because he just happened to walk into the room at that particular time.
Nice.
So
I can just imagine him pushing his wife out of the way and being like, me first.
I like that version better. So that was a little clip of Rock Your Baby by George McRae. Great song. I love it.
Yeah.
Definitely getting into the more disco sound, I think that, you know, people could more easily recognize rather than the previous song we talked about. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it wasn't very disco-y.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing there's a lot of things I could have talked about for some of these songs. I tried to cut it back, but it's still kind of long. Anyway, one thing I did want to touch on in this song before we move on, because it's relevant to our last week's episode, about artists who went bankrupt because of either decisions they made or because of, you know, just bad circumstances. So Richard Finch, who I already mentioned as one of the co-writers of the song, because this was their first like big hit that they wrote, the very first check he got for this song was $227,000. Which is basically $250,000 at age 20.
That's more than I make in forever.
Yeah, and this was in 1970s dollars, so
that's probably like $500,000 now.
Yeah, so imagining getting a check for $500,000 at the age of 20. So yeah. So basically the first thing he did apparently was buy his mom a Jaguar. Even though at the time the US was in the thick of the 70s oil crisis. Nice. So not the best idea to go buy a Jaguar. And also his mom didn't even have a driver's license. And I believe it said that she didn't get another driver's license until like 7 years later.
So she never drove it, or
basically. But because of this lack of financial foresight, that Finch had, it really bit him in the ass later down the line. Because in the early 80s, they had to re-sign some contracts to the rights of the songs from Casey and the Sunshine Band, who, you know, in the late 70s, you know, exploded in popularity.
Mm-hmm.
And because of, you know, these financial choices that he made, he basically had to give up his royalty rights for the songs that he wrote and performed, which, in terms of potential revenue in the years following, he lost millions and millions of dollars.
Ooh. They really need to learn, do not give up your royalties. That is like the last thing you ever want to give up. That's basically like your future insurance.
So yeah, I thought that was kind of interesting, that kind of tied into what we were talking about last week.
That is.
It would have been something good to mention, but
yeah,
I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah. I guess moving on from George McRae to his wife, Gwen McRae, I wanted to talk about her song, Rockin' Chair, because we haven't talked about enough rockin'.
Now you need to make a pun with the rock sitting in a chair.
The rock's rockin' in a chair. See, the rock doesn't rock the chair rocks the rock. I don't know.
Was that the theme of the movie? The chair started rocking, and then it rocked the entire world.
I was going to say the rock realized that the best place to be in an earthquake is in a rocking chair. So he hid his family inside of a rocking chair.
Well, it's like those buildings that can withstand earthquakes, right? Because they can wobble and stuff. It's the same thing with a rocking chair.
Exactly. The rock just sat in a rocking chair during the earthquake and said, yep, that's an earthquake.
That sounds like a very serious dilemma.
It is. It's funny, though, too, as we move down the list of songs that have the word rocking in it, it's like the item that's being rocked becomes more and more easy to rock. Like, it's really hard to rock a boat, and then, you know, rocking a baby requires like your whole upper body motion, but then rocking in a rocking chair, you just have to sway back and forth.
That's an observation I was not expecting from this.
Yeah, so basically, like, they just, you know, like the last song of the disco era is just going to be like rocking on the toilet or something, like the easiest form of rocking you can do.
And it's a well-known fact that rocking on the toilet is the most easy kind of rocking.
Yeah.
Anyway, why don't you tell us about Rockin' Chair?
Okay. So Gwen McRae had been performing in local clubs as a teenager and singing with local groups like the Lafayettes and the Independents. And in 1963, she met a young sailor named George McRae, who she married within a week. That sounds like a Disney movie.
I felt that was kind of insane.
Yeah.
That you marry someone within a week of meeting them?
That's just... I don't even... Especially in the 60s when divorce was way more not cool.
Hmm. But I mean, it's funny because then these songs that they were talking about of them are more than a decade later, and they were still married at that time. So apparently it worked out, at least for a decade, if not more. I assume they kind of just stayed married forever.
I was going to say, you should look up if they ever divorced.
Okay, I'll actually look that up while you talk.
Okay, so after marrying this guy within a week, starting that same year in 63, she started a recording duo with her new husband, George. And the couple was actually discovered by Betty Wright, not Betty White.
Betty Wright we have actually talked about
yes,
on this show.
Yeah, her song Clean Up Woman, I think we've talked about before.
Yeah.
So Betty Wright, she actually helped them get signed to TK Records, specifically the subsidiary Alston Records. Says that Gwen actually scored her solo contract even before her husband George did. So he's a sucker. Gwen started off with some success at TK with her R&B covers of Bobby Bland songs, who I know we've talked about. But yeah. After George shot to stardom with his song Rock Your Baby, Gwen's like, hey, I like rocking too. I'm going to write my own song. But I don't have a baby to rock, so I'm just going to sit in this chair and think about it. And then she's like, wait a second.
I think that's my favorite way that an artist ever
came up with a song,
except for the one that was not made up by us, where the guy came up with it while sitting on the toilet.
Was he rocking on the toilet though?
But we still can't remember who that was, right?
Oh damn!
Because no. We tried to figure it out.
Yeah,
I mistakenly thought it was When a Man Loves a Woman, but then we looked it up and that wasn't true. So I honestly don't remember who it was.
Oh, I don't know. We'll have to do some later research on that, because I thought we talked about that, but didn't
we? Did,
but we ended up getting it wrong.
No, we didn't get it wrong, but I just don't remember who it was, and I don't want to listen through 130 episodes trying to figure out who it was.
Touche. Yeah, definitely touche to that.
But you listeners should.
I was going to say, we don't want to listen to our stuff, but you should. We'll rock another toilet. Yeah, I'll do some Googling on that later on, and
okay. We'll
let you listeners know if we come up with it. So yeah, Gwen's just sitting in a rocking chair, writing a song about rocking in a rocking chair. And that song actually shot to become the number one R&B hit and a top 10 on the pop chart. So,
not to be confused with the Pop Tarts.
Yeah. So basically,
we're professional.
basically Gwen McCrae followed her husband's success by rocking.
That's true.
So Rock Your Baby, is that like they had a baby together and they were rocking it, or like Rock Your Baby is in like your girlfriend or significant other?
It's your girlfriend or significant other, or I guess could be boyfriend.
Well, apparently George knows nothing about having a girlfriend because he married her within a week. So,
well, you could. His baby was his wife.
Yeah, true.
Anyway, why don't we listen to a clip of Rockin' Chair?
Okay. Just rock me away from here. Let's get it on. Come to me, baby. Ooh, let me be your rocking chair.
We hope you rocked in your rocking chair to that last song.
My chair doesn't rock. I'm sad. It just swivels.
A couple of things I want to mention really quick. One, she actually does say the phrase "rock your baby" in that song at some point.
Rock your baby in a rocking chair.
Yeah. Two, like we said, listeners, they did actually have some duo, kind of duet type of music releases earlier in their careers.
Mm-hmm.
So if you really want to, you can go look up stuff that they did together rather than both coming out with popular disco songs. Mm-hmm. The third thing is that I was looking up whether they divorced. I didn't see any evidence either way.
Huh.
But I feel like if they did, it would have come up somewhere.
Are they dead? I guess that's the most important question for us.
I don't know. We always say that people are dead and then they're not, or the other way around.
Exactly.
I believe they're still alive. Gwen is, and George, I believe, still is as well.
Oh, I was hoping that like he died in her arms in a rocking chair.
Why would you hope that?
I don't. Okay, touche. I don't hope for anyone's death, but. You know, says he's 71.
Anyway.
It says he's 71, so you know, more than likely he's sitting on a porch with her in a rocking chair.
I like to think that, yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, they're both still alive, and they're both apparently still musically active.
I can dig it
to some extent. That's kind of cool. And assuming they're still together, I mean, it's kind of amazing that they got married in a week and then have been together for 40-something years.
Maybe it was arranged.
Maybe.
It was just arranged for her to meet him. It's like, oh yeah, by the way, get married. But,
anyway.
Yeah. Anyways. Speaking of old people, what do we got up next, Mr. Peter?
Well, I felt like it was appropriate for us to talk about Betty Wright. We did just mention her as kind of the person who discovered George and Gwen. But also, obviously, Betty Wright was a pretty popular singer in herself. And so I'm actually taking one step back, chronologically anyway. Rockin' Chair was from 75. The song I chose for Betty Wright, Shoo-Rah, Shoo-Rah, was from 1974. And I'll get into the reasons why I chose this song in a minute. But first, Betty Wright, if you don't know, you probably don't. She was an R&B singer-songwriter who was starting... She began her career like in the late 50s, actually. So wow. Quite a long time ago. But she really started to become popular in the 70s with her songs such as Clean Up Woman and Tonight Is the Night, etc. So she was really kind of pioneering in the whole singer-songwriter entrepreneur game, especially as a black female. And she's actually still today is only one of the few black female musicians who has ever produced a gold record on her own Vanity label in her career. So that's pretty impressive.
That's impressive.
Good for her.
Now, a Vanity label being like one that you start yourself to perform your own music?
Yeah.
Gotcha.
And to make more money for yourself too. Which we talked about last week was... can potentially have really terrible
financial
side effects. But, you know, if you play your cards right, then you can make lots of money that way.
True.
Okay, so something I want to kind of touch on is we've talked about some of the sub-labels of TK Records already.
Mm-hmm.
I do kind of want to talk about something really quick in terms of Betty Wright. So I wasn't quite sure when... her songs like Clean Up a Woman, you know, because that's probably her most famous song. I was trying to think, okay, did she release that on TK Records or on something else? Because it was a number of years before before this. And so in my research, I kind of found that it was kind of confusing, but I think I kind of figured it out. Basically, artists like Betty Wright and several others from TK, including like Jimmy Bohorn, who we'll be talking about next, were originally on Alston Records, which I think you may have actually mentioned with Gwen. Which was actually another separate label co-founded by Henry Stone and Steve Alimo, basically the same team who created TK Records, and that was back in 1964, so it was probably about a decade before TK started. So they recorded the song under Alston Records, but the distribution rights for actually, like, you know, putting it out on media and so people can buy the song were owned by Atco Records, which itself was a subsidiary of Atlantic Records.
Jesus. We need to create like a web of like how all these different record companies are connected. That'd be kind of
interesting. I know. We need some kind of graphic for this stuff. Anyway, so the distribution rights were later absorbed by TK Records in 1974, a year after it started. Thus, Alston Records became a subsidiary of TK, and the whole back catalog of Alston Records, including Betty Wright's songs, we can consider them part of TK's extended catalog in form, like from a distribution standpoint. But so songs like that weren't recorded when she was part of TK, technically. The song I chose, Shoo-Rah, Shoo-Rah, actually was the first single that she released under TK proper, which is why I chose this versus something else. So I don't know if any of that made sense, listeners, but that was... That was me actually doing research.
That's pretty good.
Which is not something I do very often here.
Yeah, that's impressive.
So, like I said, this is the first single she released under TK Records. It's actually from the first album she recorded and released under this record label. The album was called Danger High Voltage from 1974. So, yeah. I'm going to take a quick break from talking, and you listeners can do that thing you do best, which is listen to a clip.
Okay.
So one more thing about Betty Wright before we move on. She's actually still musically active today.
Nice.
Which is pretty awesome. She has two albums that came out pretty recently. Her most recent one came out last year in 2014. I'm already thinking about 2016. We're getting pretty close. And that album was called Living Love Lies. Also in 2011 was an album called Betty Wright the Movie. I don't know why she called it that, but she performed that with the Roots.
That's pretty funny. Remember in like the early 2000s when like every time there was a movie based on like a kid's show, it was always the name of the show, the movie. Like Rugrats, yeah. The movie. SpongeBob, the movie.
That's true.
Pokemon, the movie. It's like couldn't say like the Pokemon movie or Pokemon, you know, subtitle. It was always just like, hey, kids, this is that show you like, the movie.
Yeah. I've heard bits and pieces of Betty Wright, the movie, but I don't know why they called it that. So I should probably look it up and see. I don't know if there might have been like a short film that was connected to it.
In the movie,
possibly.
Was Betty Wright played by Betty White?
And it was called Betty Wright, the movie, the movie. Also, I don't think Betty White should play Betty Wright because that would require blackface, which would be terrible.
Maybe Betty Wright, the movie is just the soundtrack to the movie that never came out. Did you ever think about that?
I did not think about that.
Mind blown. It's like Betty Wright, the soundtrack to the movie, the movie.
And then they make a documentary about the movie that didn't exist.
That didn't ever happen, yeah.
And then the soundtrack to that is Betty Wright, the movie, the movie, the movie. The official soundtrack of the official movie of the movie. Oh, gosh. We're so funny, listeners.
I was going to say, we're really stupid.
Well, that goes without saying.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk a little bit about Jimmy Bohorn, Kyle?
I would like to talk about Jimmy Crack Horn. Yeah, sure. So
that's right. You did tell me that you thought Jimmy Bohorn sounded like Jimmy Crackhorn.
I'm pretty sure he's like a distant cousin, at least. So Jimmy Bohorn produced or released the song, I should say, "Let Me Be Your Lover" in 1975. Mr. Bohorn was an R&B/disco singer, grew up in West Palm Beach, Florida, so it was only natural that the bulk of his music career would reside at TK Records and its subsidiaries. Some of his songs were released under the Alston label, as mentioned previously, but the majority of his hits were actually under Sunshine Sound, another TK label featuring artists produced by John Wayne Gacy. I mean, Harry Wayne Casey.
So yeah, there's that name again. The founding guy of Casey and the Sunshine Band.
Not John Wayne Gacy.
That
too. Now I'm just imagining John Wayne Gacy with like a disco like group, but like it's him in the clown suit on stage doing disco music.
You imagine it's, funny things, Kyle.
It's like Gacy in the Murder Band.
Is there anything else you wanted to say?
Yeah, a little bit. So Mr. Bohorn's disco sound actually shows a heavy influence from Mr. Casey's writing and producing direction. The tempo, vocal style, and prominent use of horns are all actually pretty much identical to those used by Casey and the Sunshine Band. So Jimmy Bohorn is like Casey Light.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, I feel that like from a musical standpoint, his stuff sounds like very, very similar to Casey and the Sunshine Band. So, I mean, it makes sense that
it was pretty
Harry Wayne Casey was basically wrote and produced this stuff because it's exactly the same.
Exactly. Listening to this clip earlier, it is very Casey-like, mm-hmm. to the point that like you could get them confused if it wasn't for the vocals.
Mm-hmm.
And even the vocals aren't super far different.
Well, I mean, it's a black guy versus a white guy.
Casey sounds pretty black when he wants to. Come on. Do you think Casey was like raising Jimmy Bo to be his like protege so that like when Casey died it could be like JB in the Sunshine Band?
Maybe. That's definitely a theory.
It's like his ward. It's like Batman and Robin, but it's Casey and Jimmy Bo.
Oh gosh. Now I'm imagining them dressed as Batman and Robin, but the 60s version.
Nice. And doing like the disco moves of the 60s or the whatever that weird dance is where you like make peace signs over your eyes.
Yeah.
Should we play a little clip of Jimmy Crack Bohorn?
Let's do that, and then we can erase that image from our heads.
Okay.
Let me be your lover. Let me. Let me.
Jimmy Bohorn and I don't care. Jimmy Bohorn and I don't care.
We hope you listeners did care about Jimmy Bohorn.
You should care because his music actually received a lot of attention in dance clubs. Sadly, he never had a number one song, which is probably why his father, Casey, disowned him and saw him as a failure. No, I'm kidding. which is probably why most people have never heard of him. You know why? It's because he always lived in the shadow of Jimmy Crackhorn.
That could very well be it.
The closest he actually ever got was a number 8 single, Dance Across the Floor. But he was also known for such songs as Spank and You Got Me Hot.
Yeah, something I want to mention is that there's like a ton of people that we could have talked about with this label, the Take Your Records. But, you know, in the span of one episode, we can only talk about a few.
True.
I felt it was worth talking about Jimmy Bohorn just because I personally really love his sound. And, like, I don't think there's any song by him that I don't really like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, someone else picking the list of artists might have not included him, but I really like him, so I threw him in there.
I can take it. Jimmy Bohorn really rings my bell.
Does he?
He does.
Well, why don't we talk about Ring My Bell?
Damn it, Peter.
I need a word.
I freaking set that up for you so hard, and you just walked right past it.
I know.
Peter.
I'm kind of off my game tonight. Sorry, listeners.
It's okay. I am too.
Sorry?
I was just going to say, it's because of watching San Andreas. I have post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Well, you're also stressed out because we haven't had like a song with the word rock in it for a while.
I know. I'm kind of freaking out. I don't have any more puns. I have a whole bag of puns here.
Well, why don't we pretend this is called Rock My Bell?
Okay. You know, the rock doesn't ring your bell. The rock rings. Damn it. Now, see, now I lost... It doesn't work, Peter. It just doesn't work.
Why don't you think of something while I'm talking about X?
Okay. While I'm talking about things that matter.
Well, none of it matters. So anyway, Ring My Bell by Anita Ward. It's actually one we did talk about a long time ago. But here it's relevant again, because this is easily one of the biggest disco songs that came out of TK Records. And, you know, it's in itself, it's actually, I would say it stands up pretty well as a well-known disco song. This is actually the only hit song that Anita Ward ever recorded. And the funny thing about that is that it wasn't actually even supposed to be recorded by her originally. Her producer, Frederick Knight, actually wrote it for an 11-year-old, Stacy Ladisaw. But she ended up signing with a different label. So he's like, hey, Anita Ward, you should sing this instead. She actually really did not want to record this song. And I don't really know why, but she really didn't want to record it, apparently. But Frederick Knight, as her producer, basically said, you have to record it because they needed another dance number on the album that they were producing for her.
Mm-hmm.
I also read somewhere else that they actually ended up revising some of the lyrics to be a little bit more adult. Because, you know,
I was going to say about that, actually, because I was thinking of the lyrics. I'm like, aren't those lyrics a little suggestive for an 11-year-old to sing?
Yeah, they actually did change the lyrics a bit so that it wasn't, you know, it couldn't be necessarily sung by an 11-year-old.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether that helped kind of Anita Ward feel better about singing it or not, but I kind of assume that it helped.
Probably.
Even though she didn't really have a choice. Anyway, so she performed the song, and ironically, I mean, she kind of became a one-hit wonder, the song. I don't really know anything else that she's done.
Mm-hmm.
And this song sold over 1 million copies. And, you know, I think it was really popular in itself, like I said, but it's funny that she really didn't want to perform it, because if she had gotten her way,
she would never.
We probably would never have heard of her.
Yeah, that's very true. That's funny. It's like the thing you don't want to do ends up being the thing that makes you famous.
Yeah. Yeah, and we've talked about one-hit wonders a number of times on this show, and it's funny how sometimes those singers actually kind of get reluctant because they can't make another hit and that they're only known for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I can kind of see that being annoying. How you can make a big once and then never really, you know, duplicate that success.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't really know how she felt about it afterward, or if she felt that way, but it's kind of funny that, like, I don't want to record the song. It's like, okay, Well, you have to. Oh, it became really big. Oh, wait, it's the only song that you'll ever do that was popular. So that kind of sucks for her.
Yeah.
I could have sworn that she had done more stuff, but
she had a good singing voice and she could hit some pretty high notes, so it's sad that she didn't get anything else super famous.
It's a pretty catchy song too.
Yeah. Speaking of catchy, the last one we have on our list was kind of what?
You're jumping the gun, Kyle.
I do that a lot.
Well, the biggest thing of which was we didn't listen to a clip of Ring My Bell. So our listeners don't know what we're talking about.
This is true. Why don't you... Damn it!
Let's just... Okay, everybody stop talking. We're going to listen. You listeners should know that anytime you can ring our bell... on Facebook
or SoundCloud
or
Twitter.
Yeah. So again, that was Ring My Bell by Anita Ward. Basically the only song that she's known for. Really quick note before you can move on to our last thing, Kyle, sorry. Frederick Knight, the guy who I mentioned, who was, her producer, actually was an R&B singer himself. And was not in, is known for a few different songs, one of them being I've Been Lonely for So Long. And that wasn't disco, that was more of like kind of like a soul song, but I listened to it and he sounds pretty good too.
Nice.
So
I
guess makes sense that one singer eventually becomes the producer of someone else.
Yeah. Very true.
And I guess which is the same case for Harry Wayne Casey and the band that I guess it's a good lead into the band that we'll be talking about now.
Yay, tie in. Yeah, I guess it was kind of inevitable that we were going to talk about this band because they're like the heart and soul of TK, is Casey and the Sunshine Band, and specifically their song Sound Your Funky, Jimmy Crack Horn. No, Sound Your Funky Horn, which came out in 1973. So one of the earlier hits for TK.
I actually, really quick, sorry to interrupt.
Yeah.
They produced a crap ton of really popular songs, and which were all under TK Records, and until it went bankrupt in 81. But nice. I chose this one because it was the very first hit that they made. So generally we went kind of chronological, but then at the end, not really as much. Sorry, but you can continue.
No, it's all good. So yeah, as I was saying, TK or Casey was easily one of the biggest names to come out of TK Records, and this was largely due to the pioneering efforts by Harry Wayne Casey, who formed the band in 1973 and served as a musician, writer, and producer for several other artists on the label. So he's like the Barry Gordy of TK, except Barry Gordy wasn't actually in the band himself.
And Casey didn't own the record label.
Touche. That's a good question, and that might be a future funk episode, is artists that, on top of having their own bands, were influential in, writing and producing for other people.
Yeah.
That'd be an interesting topic. We might have to talk about that later on.
Yeah.
So, the band was known for dozens of disco hits, including That's the Way, I Like It, Shake, 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 Shake Your Booty, I'm Your Boogeyman, That's What I Am, and Keep It Coming Love, Get Down Tonight, Boogie Shoes, Please Don't, that's a lot of things, too many words, Peter, Please Don't Go, and Give It Up. I know five of those songs.
I mean, out of that big list that Kyle just said, I mean, that's probably still only like 2/3 of like their most popular songs.
Yeah. I have two Casey records. I don't know where they are right now, but yeah. I think Casey was actually one of the first records I got, remember? Okay, this is a funny aside, just to prove the enduring, lasting power of Casey and the Sunshine Band. So, one of my friends got me a Casey and the Sunshine Band record. I think it was the one with Shaky Booty, but I don't remember. So, this was before I ever really started collecting records. I had this idea, I think I actually got it from you, Peter, to make a clock out of the record, because I saw this thing on like Pinterest or something where you just take like a clock motor and the hands, I guess. You put it through the hole, and you create like a record clock, because the record is round. And I remember I put it in this nice record frame, put it up on the wall, it looked real nice, and then I used like one of those like shitty like command hooks that obviously didn't hold enough weight, or I got one that didn't hold enough weight. So hours later, the record in the frame comes crashing down. Frame completely shatters. But the record, amazingly, is intact. And so I'm like, well, this sucks. So I, you know, disassemble it, and I put it back in the sleeve, and I put it away. You know, months and months later, I start collecting records, and I pull this out, because I'm like, oh yeah, I forgot I had this. I play it, plays completely fine. Didn't even scratch or anything.
Nice.
Despite shattering inside of a glass case. So, Casey is strong.
It was held together by his magic.
By his disco love, yes.
That's funny.
So yeah, this stupid aside. This particular song of his, Sound Your Funky Horn, was actually one of the first songs that they released. And it was second only to Blow Your Whistle in 1973. They really love suggestive things, don't they?
Yeah.
Ring my bell, blow your whistle.
Ring my whistle, blow my bell.
Suck that corn cob. I don't know. And this was actually the first song to kind of feature an upbeat disco dance style that they were known for.
Yeah, I actually misspoke earlier when I said this was the first song they came out with. Blow Your Whistle was earlier in the same year, in 73. But I listened to that, and it was, I guess it was kind of more funk or soul, maybe. Which kind of makes a little bit more sense for the time frame.
Mm-hmm.
But then, so it doesn't really sound like anything else that they've done. But then they listen to Sound Your Funky Horn, which is a song I already knew. But I actually wrote this down, but I'll just say it now. It's like, it amazed me how close it felt to their sound, which they were known for maybe 5 years later, and which was a lot more well-aligned with like the disco sound that came around that same time later in the decade. But this is 73. This is many years before that. And I was kind of just impressed by how early that Harry Wayne Casey kind of, and on the other people as well, obviously, kind of came up with this sound and kind of innovated what would become really popular, you know, 5 to 7 years later.
True. I thought
that was kind of impressive. And it kind of shows how innovative he was when he was developing it that early on, you know?
Yeah, because exactly, you know, people pinpoint disco as like a late 70s thing, and then to realize that this sound was coming out in early 70s, 5 years prior, is kind of weird to think about. This is back when Nixon was still president. Everyone knows that the disco president was Jimmy Carter.
That's true, I guess. I guess, never thought of it that way.
I don't know, he was the president in the late 70s, so it was his peanut farming and stuff that created the disco power.
That paved the way.
Yeah, peanuts.
Why don't you think about that for a minute, Kyle, while the listeners listen to the Sound Your Funky Horn.
Okay.
Thus concludes the list that we came up with for this episode.
Oh, fun tie-in.
Okay.
So the record label is for Miami, correct?
Yeah.
The Rock played for Miami Hurricanes football team in college because he went to the University of Miami.
And a hurricane is similar to all the other stuff that happened in that movie.
Sort of, but not really.
It was a disaster.
The movie was a disaster. It all comes together in the end.
That's true. Another tie-in, actually, I forgot about this. How I said earlier in the episode how Rock Your Baby by George McRae was a song I mentioned in our first episode.
Yep.
Another thing we mentioned in our first episode
was The Rock. Was
not The Rock. It was when I went to that Casey and the Sunshine Band concert in that summer.
Oh, yeah.
And we talked about that in that episode, too. So that's two tie-ins.
Because you saw them in San Diego, right? You saw them at the San Diego Fair?
They were amazing. So
that's awesome.
Seems like we've been having more tie-ins to our early episodes lately.
Yeah. It all comes full circle. The circle of funk.
Oh, God. Well, if you made it this far, listeners, then we salute you. Because we barely did.
For those about to rock your boat, we salute you.
Mm-hmm. And if you hate us, tell us on Facebook. Facebook.
We love drinking that Haterade. Fun fact, Gatorade was also developed in Florida.
By The Rock.
I just imagine, like, they just harness The Rock's sweat, and, like, that's what makes Gatorade. Oh, Jesus. That's funny.
And it was making children cry when they drank it, so they added color to it to make it more fun.
They don't even flavor it, it's just The Rock's sweat. It's just, like, yellowish clear. Oh, Jesus.
This is a really bad time for me to tell people where to find us on social media. I don't even know if I want to say it now.
Oh, jeez. Okay.
Well, now you have a reason to hate us, and you can tell us on Facebook at facebook.com/getyourfunk. You can also subscribe to us on... Okay. I mixed a bunch of things up there. Subscribe to us on iTunes. If you search for Funk Radio in the podcast section, you can follow us, not subscribe, on SoundCloud. We have all of our episodes up there. We also have them all up on overmental.com, which is our host/home base on the internet. There's other cool things to check out there as well. Like, if you really like Star Wars and want to read about shit that has to do with Star Wars, then go read it there. If you like other cool podcasts, they are there as well.
Peter, you need to start reviewing movies again and just be like, if you want to read about Star Wars shit, read my article.
Well, I didn't write them.
I know, I'm just saying.
Yeah, for sure. Oh, boy. That's it. Technically, we're in Twitter, but we don't look at it, so don't bother. Yeah.
Don't tweet us. We won't tweet. Machete, don't tweet.
Does The Rock tweet?
No, well, he moves giant rocks on the beaches to make messages.
Wait. Before we leave. So if listeners go to twitter.com/TheRock, and I'm not kidding, you listeners can follow Dwayne Johnson, The Rock.
It's not like the real Rock or something.
The real The Rock.
Yeah, The Real The Rock. Because it seems like, you know, there's always like fake spinoff Twitters, and they always have to be like, The Real President Obama.
His description under his name on his Twitter page says, man.
Just man?
With period. Yes.
Well, The Rock is man, so.
He's also rock.
Yes. He's part rock, part man. He's like the Jewish golem. Actually, I think that was made of clay or whatever.
I think you're thinking of a dreidel.
No, in the Jewish folklore, there was a monster called the golem that was made of clay.
Well, he was made of clay? I didn't know that.
I thought it was clay. I don't know. God, why do you make me Google stuff, Peter?
Okay, we're not going to stay here and wait for Kyle to do that, listeners. You can tell us on Facebook if you know about more about Jewish folklore. Bye.
Bye.
Fucking